You'll have to look it up in the Puranic Encyclopedia. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
The numbers are dwindling as the weather gets hotter. I think we are at the top of page 431. The last three lines of page 430. All right. A will to climb. Yes, that's where we'll begin. We're in Book 6, Canto 1, The Word of Fate. And last week we were reading the response of Narad to Savitri's mother, who has realized that there's something not quite right about this marriage. And she says, she told Narad, hide not from us our doom, if doom is ours. This is the worst, an unknown face of fate. To know is best, however hard to bear. So then he speaks, and what we read so far, everything that he says about Satyavan is beautiful, that he's a very, very special person, a very, very lovable person with a beautiful soul, who was in communion with higher powers. And the last thing that we read was he gave a little description with three images of Satyavan. He says he's like a sky, a peaceful sky, a tranquil breadth of sky, windless and still, watching the world like a mind of unplumbed thought. So he has some very clear, bright witness quality about him. Calm. And then a silent space, musing and luminous, uncovered by the morning to delight. So a kind of open space on the earth, which is full of sunlight. And then he says, he's like a green tangle of trees upon a happy hill, made into a murmuring nest by southern winds. So the winds that come from the south are pleasant, gentle winds, and this trees have all tangled their branches. So he says, these are his images and his parallels. These are images for Satyavan. They are parallels to him, his kin in beauty, and in depth, his peers. Satyavan is like that, beautiful like a clear sky, beautiful like a space full of sunlight, beautiful like a tangle of green trees on a happy hill. And they are his peers, his equals in depth. All those three things are in some way deep and he is also deep. So now he's going to continue with this description of Satyavan. You'll start, Patty.
A will to climb lifts a delight to live. Heaven's height, companion of earth's beauty's charm. An aspiration to the immortal's heir, laying on the lap of mortal ecstasy. His sweetness and his joy attract all hearts to live with his own in a glad tenancy. His strength is like a tower built to reach heaven, a godhead quarried from the stones of life. O lost, if death into its elements, of which his gracious envelope was built, shatter this vase before it breathes its sweet, as if earth could not keep too long from heaven a treasure thus unique loaned by the gods, a being so rare, of so divine a make. In one brief year, when this bright hour flies back and perches careless on a branch of time, this sovereign glory ends, heaven lent to earth. This splendor vanishes from the mortal sky. Heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. 12 swift-winged months are given to him and her. This day returning, Satyavan must die. A lightning...
No, thank you. That's the place to stop. Yeah. So that's the bad news. He gives all the good news first, saves the bad news for last. I think it's quite clear. Anybody likes to ask anything?
I like this word tenancy. It's like the landlord. Are you coming to live in his heart?
So you'll go on, Don?
A lightning bright and nude the sentence fell, but the queen cried, "Vain then can be heaven's grace. Heaven mocks us with the brilliance of its gifts, for death is a cupbearer of the wine of too brief joy held up to mortal lips for a passionate moment by the careless gods. But I reject the grace and the mockery. Mounting thy car, go forth, O Savitri, and travel once more through the peopled lands. Alas, the green gladness of the woods, thy heart has stooped to a misleading call. Choose once again and leave this faded head. Death is the gardener of this wonder tree. Love's sweetness sleeps in his pale marble hand. Advancing in a honeyed line, but closed, a little joy would buy too bitter an end. Plead not thy choice, for death has made it vain. Thy youth and radiance were not born to lie, a casket void dropped on a careless soil. A choice less rare may call a happier fate."
Thank you.
She's not happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything to ask? No? Yes.
My question is, did Sri Aurobindo give a name to the queen? And if not, do you think that has a reason?
No, in the poem he does not give a name to the queen. But in the traditional legend she has a name. And Patty just found that name this morning. She's called Malawi.
This is the mother?
The mother of... And Satyavan's mother also has a name. I believe she's called Suniti, if I'm not wrong. But that doesn't come in the poem. And it's very interesting that in the whole first 300 lines of the poem that are about King Aswapati, his name is not mentioned either. It gets mentioned after that. But Sri Aurobindo's assuming that we all know the legend. It's very well known in India. And for him it's not important. For him it's the symbolic characters that are important.
So there's no reason why he does not give her a name in the poem. There's no special reason.
At the beginning he has his author's note where he speaks about the significance, and there he mentions his main characters and mentions the significance of their names. But apart from Narad, nobody else is named in the poem.
If I may say so, this reminds me of something I read this morning on the internet. Somebody had written that she's studying the Ayurveda relationship. She said the biggest mistake is to try to change
the fate
and people, when you should find the divine balance and harmony relation in it. And so that's the classic mistake this lady made. But this line, vain and can be heaven's grace, that gives me creeps.
Well, that's what she feels.
The grace is the most stupid thing a person can do.
In a way, this is one of the most drama-like passages in the poem, this canto. This back and forth, first of all the coming of Narad, and then Savitri's arrival, and then all these conversations. And now we've reached the climax. Now we got the bad news. How is everybody going to react to it? So the queen has reacted first, and her immediate reaction is, choose again. This can't possibly be the right choice. You've got enchanted there in the forest, and your heart, we trusted your heart to carry you to the right person, but it has stooped, it has leaned down to a misleading call. This can't possibly be the right choice. Even though Narad has described Satyavan in such glowing terms, but she says, a choice less rare, of somebody less special, may lead to a happier fate, the fate of being a widow after 12 months. So, but now Savitri will reply. Sergei, would you read?
But Savitri answered and fell by the red heart. The voice was calm, the face was fixed like steel. Once my heart chose, and chose us not again. The word I have spoken can never be erased. It is written in the record book of God. The truth once uttered on the earth's air effaced, by mind forgotten, sounds immortality, forever in the memory of time. Once the dust falls down by the hand of faith, in an eternal moment of the gods, my heart has sealed its throat to Satyavan. Its signature and words faith cannot efface. Its seal, not faith, not death, not time dissolve. Those who shall part, who have grown one being within, death's reach and break our voice, not our souls. If death did he? I cannot how to die. Let faith do. Let faith do with me what she will. Okay. I am stronger than death. I am great than my faith. My love shall outlast the world. Do false for me, helpless against my immortality. Faith's law might may change, but not my skills here.
Thank you. Anything to ask? To seal a troth, yes. Two people who have agreed to be married are betrothed. They have promised to marry each other. So that is called sealing your troth. I suppose it means your truth. It's you're giving your promise that you will marry this person. And it used to be legally binding. There was a, it was an offence in law that you could go and, what was it called, breach of promise. If the person who had promised to marry you then changed their mind, you could take them to court about it. I suppose it was important in the days when marriage was mainly about property.
In the Gilbert and Sullivan trial by jury, the famous trial is a breach of
promise. Promise case, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very cute, very funny.
I feel like this passage gives the, explains the power of what's in this poem. The word I've spoken can never be erased. It's written in the record book of God, the truth once uttered from the earth air of faith, by mind forgotten. Even when we forget the line, sounds immortally forever in the memory of time. So it's the vibration, the rhythm that's behind us is really powerful.
And what she means is that this word has been spoken by her soul. It's not a surface promise. And that's why it has an eternal resonance.
She seems now to know her role, because she says, I'm stronger than death, I'm greater than
death. Because this is her soul speaking, and if the soul can say that. But her mother doesn't take it like that. Her mother takes it in the same way as one of our mothers might take it, as, adolescent exaggeration. And she tells her, don't say things like that. It's not appropriate.
This is when Savitri is at her best, but later on she also has problems when the day is nearing, no? But she... the voice within comes up again, and then she remembers her inner power.
Let's wait till we get there.
No, we have to have prevision.
But also, she accepts this here once the die is called thrown by the hand of fate.
Yes, there's something like fate, and it gets decided once,
and
you can't undecide it. No, that's been settled.
Because it's written in the record book of good news, like.
When she has promised herself to Satyavan, she's done it from her soul for a reason. They are united in their souls. We read about it in book 5, and all this beautiful union that happened. So that's not something that can be undone in her consciousness. It's like that.
I would say it also means that the emanation of Divine Mother has chosen the human soul in the ultimate symbolism of the soul.
Yes.
So when she's chosen, that she's going to get the human soul and never let go.
Let it go.
That's the good news.
Yes.
Who have grown one being within, understand that they won't come because they are grown one being. That
grammar.
Yes. So there's two places here where one can look at the grammar. Actually, with this, it's just the word order. Who shall part those two people who have grown one being within? They have already been united. They are one being. So who can separate them?
The Sanskrit syntax.
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah. Mm. Yes, we find it in the Indian languages. Yeah. And the other place I noticed was, if death take him. So here the verb is, in our common speech, we would say, if death takes him. But here Sri Aurobindo is being very correct and using the conditional form.
Yeah.
If death take him, line 624.
If death take him.
So this is used in literary language, but we don't, nowadays we don't use it in speech normally. So this happens in several places where Sri Aurobindo uses a conditional or a subjunctive form, which are almost obsolete in English, modern English. Yes, exactly. We would say, if he takes. So let's move on, Mariage.
An adamant will, she tells a speech like one, but in the queen's mind, listening her words, long like the voice of a fellow woman, denying every issue of escape. To her own despair, answered her will, as when she cried, who in her heavy heart labored amid the sobbing of her hopes to wake the note of help from her dream. O child, in the magnificence of that soul, dwelling on the border of the greater world, in that world as thy superhuman thoughts, thou lent eternity to immortal hope. Here, on the mutable and immortal earth, who is the lover and who is the friend? All passes here, nothing remains the same. None is for any on this transient floor. He whom thou lovest now is stranger came, and into a far strangeness shall depart. The moment part once drawn upon life's face, which for a time was given him from within, the other things he moves in other players and laughs and face his name unknown. The body thou hast loved is cast away, and the root unchanging stuff of worlds to indifferent mighty nature and becomes food matter for the joy of others' life. But for our souls, upon the will of God, forever turning the alive and old, man's transcendent in the magic realm of the great dancer, the boundless dance.
Thank you. So Savitri is adamant. She will not change her will. And she casts her speech like bronze, something that will last forever. But to her mother, it sounds as if she's just being perverse somehow, choosing a doom that she could escape from. Sounds like the voice of a self-chosen doom, denying every issue of escape, every way out.
Also, we are doing that. Well, at that time, once you become a widow, there was no remaining. That's what the mother
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, exactly. And that's not what the mother wants for her daughter. So she can't let it go, you know. This is how, what we do. We carry things on, even though it is now clear and fixed. No, she's laboring amid the sobbing of her hopes, all her disappointed hopes. She wants to wake up some note of comfort, no, but she's not speaking out comfort, really.
It's not mentioned here, but I would imagine, considering that she's princess there, that who she marries is the next king, and thought a king, what is to happen? Is that, do you think, involved in that?
And that might have something to do with it, too. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's just the strong sentiment and sadness of the mother has also...
But what Shobindo is showing us here, and that he uses Savitri's mother throughout, to contrast our human reactions, even when they're quite noble and idealistic, with the certitude of the soul, which is something different. So what she says is quite makes quite good sense, and any mother would agree with it, no? Or any Indian mother would agree with it. Yes, yes, of course, yes. And in a way it is true, no? That our souls come and go, and we are in love with somebody in this life and we get separated. We are married and then we are sundered, separated in this boundless dance of the great dancer, of the one who is dancing all this. So she's identifying us with our changing personalities and appearances, which is not the eternal self. When Savitri says, my love shall outlast the world, doom falls from me, helpless against my immortality, fates, law may change, but not my spirit's will. She's speaking from her highest immortal being. No, most of us can't do that.
That question of taking over the kingdom, but then see which throne will they be on? Because there's Bhimasena and then there's Ashwapati. So
it would be a union of two kingdoms. No?
Oh yeah, that's nice. Why not?
Ashwapati, in the legend, he has prayed for 100 sons. That was his aspiration. Which our friend Vladimir symbolically translated for us to say that he wanted 100 realized beings like himself. He was a great rishi and he wanted... And it's a kind of echo of what Sri Aurobindo has himself said, that if I can get 100, I don't remember his exact words, so I won't try to comment. To
it's the 100 children of Satyavan Savitri, not of Ashwapati, right?
I think that's the way it gets fulfilled, yes.
Yeah.
And when he gets the boon from the mother, she tells him, don't complain, Brahma has arranged it like this. This daughter will be worth 100 sons to you. So all this is clear, shall we move on? Yeah? Rosa?
Our emotions are both life and
dying
knots of his real
wild.
seems compellingly by their passionate movements of seeking her in the inconstant link of our fluid power. To call down heaven's distant answering song, to cry to an
unceased,
bliss with all this there. Once the thing we lost the heavenly music sense to near the rhythmic cry first breath of sailors. All sweetness are doubling symbols here. Love dies before the flower in our breath. Our joys are perfumes in a
Pilot,
the unseen star.
Thank you. There's a truth in this, no? That our emotions, the emotions that we feel, are just notes, high notes that don't last long, of the music of the dancer, the eternal dancer. And his music gets changed compellingly by the movements of his heart, and as well as our hearts, our small hearts representing his heart, seeking here in the conditions of the manifestation in time. We can't keep that heavenly music. We try to call down that answering song. We are compelled to cry for bliss. But if we catch a little bit of it, once we've seized it, we lose it again. We lose the real deeper meaning of it. When we hold it too close to our human hearts, that wonderful rhythmic cry has fled or failed. all the enjoyments that we have here are symbols, baffling symbols, because we concentrate on the enjoyment instead of what is symbolized. And love in our breasts, our human breasts, dies before the lover dies. It happens. Our joys are enjoyments. They are wonderful perfumes, but too quickly the vase, the body, gets broken. It's too breakable. So, how unwise, how rash, no? To follow desire, which comes like a hurricane and carries us away. And if we allow ourselves to be carried away, if we spread the sails of our whole life to this hurricane desire that comes, and if we allow ourselves to be guided by the desiring heart, allow that to be our pilot, this is guaranteed wreck, destruction.
Maybe that's what physical hurricanes are. It's all the desires of the people who live in that place.
Oh.
That's where it tears us.
You don't believe in geology, I see.
It's a cult truth.
You'll read, Paula? O child.
O child, wilt thou proclaim, wilt thou then follow against the law that is the eternal will, the autarky of the rash Titan's mood, to whom his own fierce will is the one law, in a world where truth is not, nor life, nor God? Only the gods can speak what now thou speakest. Thou who art human, think not like a god. For man, below the god, above the brute, is given the calm reason as his guide. He is not driven by an unthinking will, as are the actions of the bird and the beast. He is not moved by stark necessity, like the senseless motion of inconscient things. The giants and the titans' furious march climbs to usurp the kingdom of the gods, or skirts the demon magnitude of hell. In the unreflecting passion of their hearts, they dash their lives against the eternal law and fall and break by their own violent mass. The middle path is made for thinking man. To choose his steps by reason's vigilant light, to choose his path among the many paths is given to him. For each his difficult goal, hewn out of infinite possibility. Leave not thy goal to follow a beautiful face.
Thank you. The Titans, of course, are beings in Greek mythology. In fact, they are the original gods, the original divine beings, the elemental beings before the coming of the heavenly Olympian gods. And we find in Savitri Sri Aurobindo using the word as an equivalent for the Sanskrit asura. It's the superhuman being, but ego-centered. Either the asuras are usually centered in the mind, the rakshasas more in the desire being. So the Titan, it's mentioned here, no, that they what they do is they want to usurp, they want to take over the kingdom of the gods, they want to destroy the gods. Or it runs very close to the demon greatnesses of hell. And they actually cause their own ruin by this kind of ambition. They dash their lives, they attack something which is eternal and unassailable, the eternal divine law. So they can't help but fall and break by their own violent mass, the largeness of their formation. Yes, that's what
and
she says.
The queen is saying,
there aren't any eternal moments.
Yes.
Or she says, what you speak, it's like a divine being, but you are human, so don't go beyond your scope. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't claim something, thou who art human, think not like a god. And then she very nicely categorizes what is the human path. Like the Greeks, she says, you know, don't excess in nothing, no? Man is given the calm reason as his guide. We are not, human beings are not supposed to be driven by unthinking instinct like the birds and beasts, and we are also not supposed to be moved just by stark necessity as matter is. No? The middle path is made for thinking man. Moderation in everything. Human beings are supposed to choose their steps by the clear, alert light of the reason. And they're supposed to choose their path, using the reason to choose among the many possible paths. That's the dharma of human beings. Each of us has to find our own difficult goal, which we have to cut out, or has been cut out for us from infinite possibility. Each of us has to. So this actually is perhaps quite true about being a human being, that we have to find our way. We are given the possibility of choice, and as long as we are in the mind, the highest light that we can use normally is the reason. So,
why should Savitri not take that way?
why should she not follow reason?
Yeah,
yes,
right.
Yes, I think this will become clear.
Okay.
She said the queen has the cult knowledge she's picked up somewhere, but she's misapplying it because she doesn't have...
No, she's a cultured Indian aristocrat of the classical age or the great age, no, the golden age.
But he's not backing her up. He's keeping quiet because he knows better, isn't he? Yeah.
This is an opportunity that Sri Aurobindo's taking to explore certain viewpoints, you know, and share them with us.
The arguments are the same arguments that could be used by death,
yes.
The impermanence of things, there's no divine in the manifestation.
Yes.
Be reasonable and go back to normal life.
Yes, be reasonable, yes. Yes.
Goes to show how weak the mind actually is.
Yeah.
Being reasonable.
Well, we are supposed to be reasonable, I mean, as long as we haven't got a higher light. No?
Exactly, yeah. We live within this, and that's very
reasonable. I think it's a good justification, too, of the young people of the new age who have to go against their parents. So when they have to stand up for the inner truth they know, you know.
So let's read on, Audrey.
Only when thou hast climbed above and high, and lived in the calm vastness of the One, can love the eternal and the eternal bliss, and love the high replace the human high. There is a shrouded law in our spirit force. It be strengthened by a hand spirit. It offers severe
benignancies.
Of work and thought and measured grave delight as steps to climb to God's far secret height. Then in our life a tranquil pilgrimage, each year a mile upon the heavenly way, each dawn opens into the larger light. Thy acts are thy efforts, all events are signs. Waking and sleep are opportunities given to thee by a mortal power. So canst thou raise thy pure, unvanquished spirit, till it spread to heaven in the wide vestal calm, indifferent and gentle as the sun. This greatens slowly into time.
No, let's stop there. Yeah. So this is the sattvic ideal. Living a reasonable, virtuous life and aspiring for higher truth to achieve some kind of calm vastness. And to look at the world as a way of helping us to achieve that by self-discipline. It offers us these severe benignancies, these benign opportunities of work and thought and measured grave delight, not going overboard and getting excited and carried away. No. These are the steps to to climb to God's far secret heights. And then our life is a pilgrimage. And every year is a mile. Each dawn opens into a larger light. All that we do are helpers. Everything that happens has a significance. Even waking and sleep are opportunities given to us by an immortal power. There's a truth in this. Mm-hmm. In this way, you can purify and lift up your unvanquished spirit until it opens to that calm vastness of the One. Mm-hmm. Great and slowly into timeless peace. So all this is true, but it's not applicable in Savitri's case.
Mm. But it justifies Sri Aurobindo calling her wise. It shows that after she exalted all her lower responses, then she got to the highest part of herself. It's interesting, huh?
And this theme of the pilgrimage and the titan and the pilgrimage and so on, Narad will take it up in the next canto, in canto 2.
Mm-hmm.
Which word? Benignancies. Benignancies. Benign is the opposite of malign. It's full of goodwill. It's wishing you well. Well, it is in a way almost. We think that things that are benign are kind and gentle, but sometimes they can be severe for our own good. No, so that gives us this way of self-discipline for our own benefit, for our own good.
But she still thinks peace, timeless peace, is the goal.
So what does Savitri reply? I think we can finish the canto today. Patricia.
Savitri replying with steadfast eyes. My will is part of the eternal loop. My fate is what my spirit's strength can make. My fate is what my spirit's strength can bear. My strength is not the Titan's, it is God's. I have discovered my glad reality beyond my body in another's being. I have found the deep, unchanging soul of love. Then how shall I desire a lonely good or slay aspiring to white, vacant peace? The endless hope that made my soul spring forth out of its infinite solitude and sleep. My spirit has glimpsed the glory for which it came, the beating of one vast heart in the flame of flames, my eternity clasped by his eternity, and tireless but the sweet abysms of time, deep possibility always to grow.
Thank you. So through this poem, from the beginning to the end, there are certain themes which are running like threads in a symphony or threads in a fabric. Mm. And here she mentions several of them. One is about will, and another is about fate. Mm. And another one, perhaps the central golden thread, is love. Mm. These themes run through the whole poem, and here she gathers them up together. No? Again, the soul speaking, no? Able to say that my will, my individual will, this expression of my will, is part of, it's an expression of the eternal will. And then she sees that fate is not something imposed on the soul. It may seem like something imposed on the individual. And she says, my fate is what my spirit's strength can make. And my spirit's strength will make a challenge that is as much as it can bear. So this strength that you see in me now, it's not the Titans. This is not egoistic self-will. This is an expression of the divine strength in me. And why am I so strong? I am so strong because I've discovered who I really am. I've discovered my glad reality. Not here in this little limited being, in the reality of another being. I found and experienced the deep, unchanging soul of love. So don't try to tempt me by talking about peace, a lonely peace, no? Or lonely achievement. I've discovered this endless hope that made my soul spring forth out of its infinite solitude and sleep. Why has the soul made this choice to come into the manifestation? There's a hope, a tremendous hope. And there's a glimpse of a glorious possibility for which the soul accepts embodiment. And this hope, this glory, she expresses it like this: the beating of one vast heart in the flame of things. And that will be expressed individually by the embrace of Satyavan and of the souls of Satyavan and Savitri, my eternity clasped by his eternity. And the manifestation offers the deep possibility always to love, because there's this promise of endless time, perpetual, eternal recurrent of time. So she feels that these two souls will be tireless of the sweet abysms of time. These endless depths of time offer so much possibility for the experience of the soul.
Love and faith, they come twice. Strength comes three times. And then that eternity, eternal and eternity, they come three times. So I was thinking the thing that the queen is missing is this experience of eternity.
This other dimension.
But she doesn't have the experience of eternity.
Yes. Yeah.
Mother said we live in eternity.
And what I see here is the courage of tradition. So she was born a princess, she was born in a quiet conformity. And by then she took on a chariot and she goes to look for her life. And now she has found her life and she has the courage to defend her life, which is out of the conformity where she's, her mother is trying to bring her back.
Yes. Mihong, will you read?
This is the first, last joy and the truth itself, the riches of a thousand fortunate years are poverty. Nothing to me are death and grief, or ordinary life and happy days. And what to me are common souls of men, or eyes and lips that are not satavan? I have no need to draw back from its arms, and as discovered paradise of its love and journey into a serious infinity. Only now for my soul in satavan, I treasure the rich occasion of my birth. In sunlight and a dream of the emerald wave, I shall walk with him, like a god in paradise. If for a year, that year is all my life, and yet I know this is not all my fate, only to live and love a wife and die. For I know now why my faith came on earth, and who I am, and who he is, I love. I have looked at him from my immortal self. I have seen God to my agony in Satyava. I have seen the eternal in human face. Then none could answer to her words. Silent. They sat and looked into the eyes of the
love and joy are the real wealth, the real paradise.
So 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay.
Would you just sort of put the big symbolic picture out there again? I find that at certain points it's easy to get pulled into the idea of Satyavan was a man, Savitri was a woman, even though she was divinely inspired and following this divine path. But I'm always challenged to get back to remember that Savitri is an emanation of the highest divine force in material creation.
Yes.
Satyavan is the evolution of the evolving soul within.
How does he put it? He just says the soul, I think, he says. The soul which carries... Satyavan is the soul, carrying the divine truth of being within itself, but descended into the grip of death and ignorance. And this is really the crucial point, that the soul accepts, decides, agrees to descend into the grip of death and ignorance. And it needs to be helped to escape from that. And so the supreme creative force helps. And in this case, the grace is shown embodied as Savitri. And yet he says at the end that this is not a mere allegory, and these are not personified qualities. There are poems like that. No? But these are incarnations or emanations of living and conscious forces with whom we can enter into concrete touch. And they take human bodies in order to help man and show him the way from his mortal state to a divine consciousness and immortal life. It's always worth going back to the author's note.
I'm thinking in the original story of Mahabharata, it was about this man and this woman. But Sri Aurobindo has raised it up to this relation of divine mother and the soul.
He puts it a different way. He says that's the way it's recited in the Mahabharata, that it's a story of conjugal love conquering death. But then he says, but this legend is, as shown by many features of the human tale, one of the many symbolic myths of the Vedic cycle. So that's how he saw that story. And when he's retold the legend, he's brought out those symbolic aspects, those mythic aspects, which according to him were there in the origin of the story. And it's very, very interesting that many stories that are told as fairy stories or legends, they are really symbolic stories, or they have that symbolic weight and significance in them, and that really enriches our appreciation of them, if we can just touch that deeper, richer meaning, which somehow has got popularized. You know, maybe the symbolic myths were the ways of remembering deep truths, and I think that's what Sri Aurobindo has given us here. You know?
But didn't Sri Aurobindo say this is the first time the Divine Mother is ever incarnated in one body, all her powers in one body?
I don't think he put it quite like that.
Because in the past she was in Vibhuti.
Oh, you mean now, our mother, yes.
So that's what I'm thinking, when he was writing this book, he was giving man the way to link up with Divine Mother.
Yes.
And also what I said earlier, that funny idea that I got, is also about reuniting the two parts of India, in Pakistan, and because this, where she was born was in present-day Pakistan, and where he was in present-day India.
In present-day Nepal, I believe.
Well, it's in Rajasthan in the dictionary. Okay. I haven't been able
okay.
to find it, but
okay.
Anyway, it's a guidebook.
So let's close by hearing motherly. Yes.
why my spirit came on earth, and who I am, and who is my love. I have looked at him from my immortal self. I have seen God smile at me in Satyava. I have seen the Eternal in a human face.
Thanks to Sherpin. So it's a hurricane is there.
Quake is definitely bad.
Huh?
It says something about the quaking.
Yeah.
I didn't reply. I was waiting for your
meantime,
I'm trying to figure it out.
So you wanted which one?
The big one.
The big one. Okay.
I'm leaving tomorrow.
Yes. Okay. Have a wonderful trip. When will you be back?
In 15 on
July.
How to listen to the record as possible?
I don't know whether it has been started, but the idea is that they will be on the website.
Doesn't need password, so it's possible. Mm-hmm. I know his website because sometimes I go to.
Formerly, he was doing it with Dropbox.
Yes, I remember.
But this was not working. So I think Anton is here now,
mm-hmm.
and that he's supposed to organize this.
This is good.
And the idea was that it would start from the most recent one.
Mm-hmm. Good, so I can follow
Thank you.
Okay.
You're okay with walking? Okay. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry? In where? Delhi, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
There's a possibility that it might rain.